That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
And each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is John Rosman, director of the new film New Life, which we both have gushed about on Little Cuts, our mini episode. Welcome to the show, John. I'm so excited that you're here and that people get to see New Life soon.
Oh, yeah. I'm thrilled to be here, and it means the world that you guys watched it and you guys are plugging it. And I'm really excited for other people to watch it as well.
It's so good. But I'm curious how you describe it, because it's one of those films that I think knowing very little about benefits the journey through it. So, but how do you describe it to people that want to know what it's about?
It is this really weird tightrope pitch. So I open it up. Okay, we're in the pitch meeting right now. There's like a young woman on the run, and it opens up and she's covered in blood and she has a black. We don't know why. And quickly we meet the person who's charged with bringing her in. And we're starting to learn about both their lives a little bit, and they seem pretty far apart. And then they start getting a little bit more close. And then by the middle of the film, it kind of explodes into a horror movie. And then by the end of the film, kind of their stories really kind of intersect.
Yeah.
Does that work? Is that a good pitch for it?
No, that works perfectly. That works perfectly.
Yeah.
No, I'm curious because one of the big things before I even saw the movie, when I found out that is it Sonia Walger? Is that how you pronounce her name?
Yeah.
When she's in it, because I have loved her since Lost. And then I'm obsessed with For All Mankind. And she's so good in everything she's in. So I'm curious what it was like working with her, how she got involved with the project and everything.
I agree. Sonia is just one of these actors that you see like in projects, and they're always good. We went to Sonia directly for that very reason. And she really liked the script and wanted to talk about it. And I think we both quickly aligned. Her character has ALS. And it's important to the story. It probably can sound random, just throwing it out there, but it makes sense in the story. But like, you know, we wanted to get it right and actually do the work. So it was important for me to find an actor who cared that much to actually do it, you know, properly. And I think Sonia reading the script wanted to also see my dedication. So I think that was like one of the many times we just really just kind of naturally found, like had this middle ground. But working with her is really incredible. I learned a lot. You know, this is my first film, feature length, and Sonia, you know, has worked a lot. But she is so prepared and so dedicated. And we read through the script, you know, and her and I worked really closely. And she, you know, helped shape this character in a way that she felt really strongly about. And then she really came to set with like a huge binder, right? And then like everything has notes, everything has all this process in it. So when her and I are working, it's really this like very, very dedicated kind of shorthand, because it's like a glacier of work, you know, she's done. And you just see like a crevasse on it when you're working with her on set. So it's this awesome
spirit. That's amazing.
Wow.
But yeah. I also wanted to hear more about why ALS and why you wanted to incorporate ALS and Sonia's character kind of going through that experience of learning her diagnosis and slowly watching her body kind of freeze up.
You know, I think broadly this film kind of deals with like something that's going to happen to all of us when our body kind of stops responding the way we want to, and that's aging and then eventually coming to terms with death. And ALS itself is a really terrifying, terrible disease, and we don't know as much about it as we should. But if you imagine like a coloring book and you have a red marker and you start shading in from the extremities, from your fingertips to your toes and slowly covering the entire body until the heart. That's kind of how ALS works. So you start like with the dexterity of your hands and the movement of your legs. But your brain is functioning mostly for the entire time as you're kind of watching this disease. And so I think like thematically having a character whose body is shutting down, she's fully aware of it. And she has to come to terms with it and kind of these themes of like becoming accepting of it. And this isn't the life she deserves or wants or asked for, but like, you know, coming to terms with it, makes kind of thematical sense in the story. Yeah. And then, you know, why I kind of landed on ALS, I have, you know, personal experience like within my family with it, but more so I used to do journalism and I was working with the team and we interviewed a young woman who had written a memoir and she was in late stages of ALS where she was typing by sight on screen. But I looked at her and she was around my age and she had this terrible disease, but I was really taken aback by how she spoke of it with hope. And how there's like this well of like empathy and humility and all these things that like were really surprising to me when someone was facing something so great. And when I started doing research and, you know, reading and talking to people and interviewing people, I kept on seeing that throughout over and over again, these themes of like, you know, adjusting your life, learning how to live moment by moment, day by day, and being really grateful and kind of coming away from something so like crazy and hard and difficult with this really optimistic, radical hope. And I found that really inspiring and I wanted to include it in the story.
It's such a hard disease because I knew someone that whose husband was in the late stages of that and was hospitalized and just sort of seeing what she had to go through for the person that she loved, it's heartbreaking. So I really liked her performance in this. And I it's something that it feels on one hand, like a small character, you know, trait, but at the same time for what you're doing here in New Life, it feels, without getting into specifics, it feels very pertinent to the story. So I appreciated that, seeing that. And this movie is about sort of like facing that unknown. And I'm at the age now where I have parents that are running into medical issues. And so seeing sort of like the idea of MS and the idea of dementia pop in, it's sort of like, ooh, this is, it hit me harder than I was expecting for a movie about someone that's chasing after another person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think that's really, as we all acknowledge, a testament to Sonia being this great, you know, working actor. And, you know, I also think that kind of that point where it is this kind of universal thing that we're all going to have to face. And I'm happy that it resonated with you in that way, but it is, you know, working on this project as well. Like I definitely thought about my body by the end of it in a very different way. It was surprising.
Yeah.
Well, and again, like we don't see disability kind of represented like this in horror either. So it's cool to see how seamlessly you integrate the experience of someone's experience with disability into a genre, I guess I won't say horror, but like a genre film. It's just, again, it's that kind of representation that's so important to see in the kinds of the genres expanding.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I love, you know, we'll get into this. I've loved horror movies for like way too young. I got into really gnarly horror movies. But, you know, so I love this genre and I always wanted, it was, you know, I was going to make a movie and it would always be a horror movie. But I think, you know, I was really nervous to show people in the ALS community like a horror movie, right? Because there isn't a lot of, like you said, Mary Beth, like not a lot of representation within the genre space. And so like, how would that go over? And people were really excited to just see it and talk about it. And, you know, Terry, as you're saying, like it is so common and we don't know about that much, but also on the flip of it, I think it is a testament to people like Sonia and like my whole team and myself, you know, being open to it. Like, it's like, okay, here's ALS. And it's not just like, okay, we want to figure out something to talk about to make our film stand out. It's like, it's thematically important to the story. And then doing the work. So, you know, my biggest fear is just looking like an asshole to someone who has ALS. So trying to make it believable. But when you do that, you can be open to actually being surprised by it. And I think when that's like a cyclical process where then someone watching that film who might be facing that or have a family member facing that will see themselves in it. And I think that's just kind of a testament also to just like trying hard to just get it right and being humble to like everything you don't know.
Yeah.
Heavy stuff for Jason Goes to Hell.
Yeah. I love it. I love the contrast. It's really incredible.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you mentioned that you've been a fan of the genre for a very long time. So let's take it back. How did you get introduced to the horror genre?
Well, we'll get into, you know, Jason Goes to Hell. But I watched that movie in first grade. So that was a big one. I had older siblings. And this was a time when everyone was dubbing VHSs. So in fifth grade, fifth grade was a big year for me because we had the dub of like a Scream in my house. And okay. I love Scream. And then my brother had Species, which was a pretty intense film to watch at a young age. But Scream really stood out to me as this awesome film. And, you know, I think it was just, I watched a lot of movies, but the one that really, really stuck with me that like I started to hang some of my identity on was when I was 14 and I saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the first time.
Okay. And
yeah, it was like this family event and everyone like was kind of off drinking and I was like too young to like want to do that, but I didn't feel that cool not wanting to do that. And so it was on the TV and I was like, oh, well, I'll like watch this like scary transgressive movie and that will be my rebellion. And that movie, like, I was just so blown away. And it was so intense and insane. And it really was this thing where, like, it became, like, punk music or something where it's, like, you can forge a little bit of an identity with it and it became, like, your thing a little bit.
Yeah.
And then over time in college, I was, like, always the guy people would ask. And, you know, you could recommend, like, Slaughter High or From Beyond or something, you know, and, like, do the horror movie party DJ thing. So, but I really think it was Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And as I get older, it's still my favorite just because it's so much of that movie is just serendipitous. And it's like the film stock and the performances and just how it all came together. None of it should have worked. It should have all blown up. But somehow it just kind of came together and it's this like miracle of a film. And it just looks better every year and it's still intense. And they get it and it's so scary and there's like really no blood in it. It's just all suggestive. It's crazy. It's a spellbinding.
I'll never forget the very first time I watched it, which is how I think every single person should watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the first time. I was in college by myself in a dorm room. I rented a shitty VHS tape that was like had been run through so many times that it looked worse than VHS normally does.
Yeah.
And I'm watching this movie and it's the moment when he puts her on the hook that I was like, what am I watching? Because especially with like the grunginess of the tape, it's just it made it feel even more gross. Sinister than it actually is. So it's just like it's just a gross movie that I think, sure, I have a 4K edition of it. You know, I have all the cleaned up, but I'll tell you, there is nothing about finding like a VHS, popping it in, and then seeing what is left of a tape that has been played hundreds of times on your small CRT TV. Nothing like it.
Oh yeah, it's like warpy and weird and gray. Like I feel the exact same way about The Thing. Like I think I've seen that movie in every single format, including like at Sinestia where they blow it up and you watch it in a cemetery. Like I've seen the 4K or whatever, but I just still have this like kind of beat to shit VHS where like it's like you can't even tell it's snow sometimes. And I'm like, there's something really special about watching it.
Oh with, yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah. So were you easily scared as a kid when you watched horror movies?
Yeah, I mean, of course, like, some of the stuff is really scary. And then, like, I don't know, I had like a friend at a young age who also had an older brother. And we both like I have a great childhood, like amazing childhood, like the most insanely supportive parents of all time and very sheltered. But for whatever reason, him and I just like had our free reign of Blockbuster and like, Jesus Christ. Like, it was just like, I don't know how we got away watching some of these movies. And yes, they're all scary. And, you know, like, you don't think they influence you, but, you know, then they fully come out. It comes out in the most bizarre way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and then do you still get scared as an adult watching horror movies, or is it like a different kind of fear for you?
Yeah, well, I think so. Yes, I do. And like, I really like it. I mean, I think like a horror movie for me, and, you know, something that I really tried hard for with New Life, right? Because like at the top, we're talking about these heady ideas and all these things. And I think that's important and interesting, and there's a lot of opportunity in it. But like, I like horror movies that still feel like a roller coaster ride. And like, you can't, like, and my movie, like, it's a slow burn. So it starts off, you know, like it has its own pace to it. But I really tried to still, like, if someone's buying a ticket to see a horror movie, I still by the end want to satisfy that. Like, it still needs to be entertaining, which I really firmly believe in. And I think that's actually like a strong suit of the genre. So, like, for example, Love Talk to Me, I was like, holy shit, I haven't seen like a movie that like is like scary, like in this way, and like on like a blockbustery level in a long time. Really liked Where Evil Lurks, or When Evil Lurks, when, or whatever.
Yeah, yes.
Movie fucking rips and is creepy and scary. I watched Threads for the first time like a year ago.
Wow.
And that movie, yeah, exactly. Like that movie just stayed with me, and I was so depressed. And my girlfriend at the time's like, "It's like, John, you really need to get over this movie." And I was like, "I don't. There's something really disturbing and bizarre about that movie."
That movie, boy, that was someone's pick on the podcast, and that movie is just it's something else. Let me tell
you, I've had to watch that movie more than once. Why?
I'm saying.
I never want to watch it again. It's so fucked. And like, nuclear war is like one of my biggest fears. Anyway.
Well, what do you think is about that movie that is so disturbing?
I think it just feels so real. Like, until the end, when like
until the very end
where it's like weird mutant babies running amok on the barren apocalyptic landscape. That's weird. But like
That part
kind of takes you out of it. But, like, it feels just so harrowing in its depiction. And I think there's nothing that from that time that was like that, except for, like, animated stuff, like Grave of the Fireflies or...
When the Wind Blows
and, like, Barefoot
Have you seen that one?
No, should I see that one? Is that one going to fuck
me
up?
No, you don't do it.
It's so sad. It's
so
basically Threads.
It's sad.
But it's Threads, but it's animated, and we're following this like one couple, this old couple that reminds me like of my parents, and they're sort of like following through with what the government is saying to do of like making the little tents and the little pavilion stuff in their house, and just watching their lives deteriorate over the course of an explosion, and it's so fucking sad.
In, like, the most sweet animation style, we were like, I can't do it. It's just it's two sweet old British people.
Well, I think that's the upsetting thing. Like, if you watch a ton of horror movies, like, you know, rewatching Jason Goes to Hell last night, it's like there's parts of it where you just like roll your eyes, but then there's other parts of it you're just like, oh yes, this is awesome, this is really fun. But I think as you get older, the things like Threads where you're like, Jesus, would I prostitute myself to eat a rat if I was starving? Probably. And then it's like, or it's like, you know, you watch like Beasts of the Southern Wild and you're just like, I'm just like bawling. I'm like, they just want to be free. Like, why can't they just like live a life they want? Or like come and see or something? Really fucks me up.
Jesus. These movies, they're so good, but it's like, why? Why am I watching this? Yeah. Like, why am I putting myself through this? God.
Right. I mean, isn't that kind of what Ari Aster, he's like, I want to make like a weird existential horror movie, and like that's kind of the mark for Bella's Afraid. I don't know what that, it was fun. I really liked it. I just strapped in the roller coaster. I'm like, okay, bizarre art film.
Bring it.
I had like done a deep dive into his short films, so I was like, oh yeah, no, this is like more what he usually does, just weird neurotic ramblings. And I, you know,
well, like Meet the Johnsons, right? That
the strange thing about the Johnsons.
That's a strange thing. I think I was gonna skip that one out.
Yeah, really, you don't have to watch that. I have. Don't do it. It's okay. It's well made, but anyway. No, John, what movie did you bring with you today for us to discuss?
As I brought up, I have brought Jason Goes to Hell.
Hell yeah.
Which has the shortest IMDb synopsis ever.
Which is simply, yeah, serial killer Jason Voorhees' supernatural origins are revealed.
That's it. Bum, bum, bum. That's all we have to go on from IMDb. All right. But on that note, take us back, John. What about this movie was made it your Scarred for Life pick? How did you see it? When did you see it? Why is it? Give us your horror story. I want to know.
It is so crazy to me, like, rewatching this film. I saw it in first grade. He must have been with his, like, Peter Pan Lost Boys, you know, ruffians at Blockbuster. No, I was like, with a babysitter, with my siblings. My parents were definitely out to dinner.
Classic.
They got divorced a couple years later. I'm not going to say it's because I watched this film, but no, I'm not going to blame their divorce. I'm just messed up. But I was in first grade, and somehow my older sister brought this home from Blockbuster. But she, just been like middle school or something. So it was like very inappropriate across the board. And I remember I was like sitting in my babysitter's lap, and she would just obviously started to cover my eyes during some, whether it's a gruesome takedown or one of the numerous sex scenes or like whatever. Like, but so it's like rewatching it, there's all these little moments where I'm like, oh my God, like I don't remember the crazy like kills or whatever, but I'll like remember like this scene where someone's fingers are getting snapped. It's like, which doesn't make any narrative sense, but I love it. I think it's really fun, and I think it's a fun choice. So that's my origin story with it. And so watching it through the like slits of the fingers of my babysitter, and then her and a lot of my siblings like yelling, like during the tent scene, once this started to become like a softcore porn scene, my eyes obviously were covered. And then I just heard the whoa, from the kill. That's the origin story. And that's why it scarred me for life, I think. Just being young.
Wow. Yeah. So what I love is the idea that your babysitter was covering your eyes, because my whole big thing, and the thing that comes up a number of times on the podcast, is whenever I was young, my parents gave me like initially this decree that I had to cover my eyes whenever there was sex or nudity. And so like there was all these movies, particularly as I was watching the Friday the 13th movies, where I had to have my eyes closed. And it got to the point where it's like, okay, I'm watching this movie, I have to sit here with my eyes closed. And so I would do that like on command, just like, I can't watch the nudity, but I can watch everything else. But it's just so like to hear this, that you're sitting on your babysitter's lap, who, by the way, a lot of times whenever a babysitter comes up, it's always like not something wholesome where like they're trying to cover you and make sure that you're not seeing the bad stuff. It's more about, hey, you want to see something scary. So yeah, I love that she was trying to protect you.
Yeah. I mean, she's really sweet. She was really like part of our family for a while. And so I knew her really, really well. And so she was very maternal. Right. And, but also just I think she's trying to protect me, and also like maybe wanted me to feel included, or I don't know the psychology behind that happening. But yeah, and watching a Friday the 13th movie and covering your eyes from the nudity, it's like that's like one of those weird franchises where they like mix that with the kills. So
yes,
yeah. Too bad.
Yes,
too bad. Can't see it.
I'm dying to hear Mary Beth chime in on this, because this was a first watch. But before we get to her with this movie, I remember seeing this sometime. When did it come out? It came out in
93.
Wow, that's even. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So I probably saw this when I was in my teens. I'm not sure when, but because my parents weren't allowing me to see rated R movies up until a certain point, and this would have been in that time. So I probably saw this when I was trying to catch up on all the Friday the 13th movies that I missed as a young kid. And this was my first time watching it since then. And the only things that I could remember were the homoerotic shaving scene.
Wild, wild scene. And he shaves off his mustache. He's like, fuck.
Yeah.
What was that? So why?
Like, We've gone into some BDSM like area where he is tied to a table in BDSM gear, and he is being shaved. He's completely naked and he's being shaved. And the amount of like kissing in this movie to like transfer the heart, I guess. Yeah. So I remember that, and I remember the opening, because I think, even though I have issues with this movie, I think that opening is such a fantastic, campy, like, subversion of what a typical Jason movie is. I love the opening, but that is literally all I remember about. Oh, and then Freddy's glove at the end coming down. So, like, that was my only memories of seeing this movie were the homoeroticism, the opening scene, and Freddy's glove.
Wait.
I was just going to say it was a real win for body positivity in the homoerotic shaving.
You know?
Because it's just like this like random cop, and it's just like, and he was just like splayed on the board with like these, you know, leather belts and stuff.
Yeah. You know, the elder generation that are, you know, a little dad bod going on. Like it was great. So Mary Beth, did you not realize that the claw comes in at the very end?
I guess the fuck not.
Yeah, like after he's like the mask is there and it's covered by the dirt and the wind starts blowing it off and it's the mask there, then Freddy's arm comes up and grabs the mask and Kane Hodder's version of Jason's laugh comes up.
It's there's like the walking at the sunset with like the cheesy strings. There's like nah, 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 nah. and then a dog runs by. It was one of the many times, like that dog shot. Like, this movie has a lot of surprising coverage and shots and then sequencing that I actually enjoyed quite a bit. And that opening is a really good example where you don't know where the scare is going to come from, and they're just kind of playing with the viewer. And it's like kind of, they kind of go through the Rolodex of like Friday the 13th, like tropes of where the jump scare will go.
They do.
I thought that was really smart and fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this opening in particular. I made these notes too. Lots of classic horror fakeouts, where it's the shed door that, you know, bangs, or it's like her body covering the camera when she is leaning to turn the light bulb, and you just know when she gets back that there's gonna be someone standing behind her, and there's not. Or the biggest one is the mirror, where it's like always the villain is revealed in the mirror, and like, she leans down, you're like, oh, he's gonna be there, and he's not. I do love those fake outs so much.
I can't believe I Mary fucking Beth, your mind that. Is like, I can't believe it. How did I fucking stop the movie like right before? Oh my god.
I mean, literally the characters were walking off into the sunset. You are excused.
Anyway, sorry. I had it up on the another window, like, what the fuck? So I had to just confirm. Jesus.
Well, I am curious about your thoughts now. If you're like, okay, we're done here. We're going to close the chapter out in this book. They walk off in the sunset.
Well, this is my first time seeing it.
And I think it's important that you mention which movies of this you've seen.
I've seen 1, 2.
Both for the podcast.
10. And then the 2009 one. And then now this one. So okay. I am not a big Friday the 13th, like, I don't have anything against it. It's just, like, not a franchise that I have, like, sped to see all of the entries in, I suppose. I think Jason Voorhees is a little bit boring. Sorry. That's just my opinion. This movie is
I think that's a very valid one.
This movie is incomprehensible. Like, this movie is fucking incomprehensible.
The text that I got from Mary Beth as she was watching this afternoon,
I was like, I'm sorry,
quite entertaining.
Did the FBI just corral Jason Voorhees into like a trap
a kill
and
zone?
Explode him, and it's only and the first like 5 minutes of the movie? What,
like,
in the
I was like, wait, what? Like, I forgot, it's like the shot, like a zoom of a guy being like, incoming, and then there's like a missile that takes
like
out.
What in the fuck? And then hearts are eaten and there's zombies and it's just, there's a dagger that's like an Arthurian legend where only the women can, there's just so much going on in this movie. And
well,
it's
so
wow.
It wasn't the women, It was the relatives of Voorhees were the only ones that could wield it.
It wasn't the women of Voorhees. Sorry.
Like, I made born it, of a Voorhees, I made it too, death by a Voorhees or something.
I made it too feminist. I was like, only the women Voorhees can slaughter Jason. That would have been cool.
Yeah. Okay. But I am happy you bring up the heart scene. So there's this scene where, okay, after a missile strike, Jason is taken out and his head flies in the air and his campion. It's like if Sam Raimi had done a bunch of Quaaludes and made a movie, the movie he would have made.
Honestly.
And so then there's this beating heart, and I remember this because this is the scene that actually scarred me, you know, where I was like, because the opening scene, I bet my babysitter was like, okay, kind of cheesy. I mean, it was 93, so I don't know. It was still probably pretty heavy. But anyways. And then it's an autopsy scene as part of the opening title sequence. And then the heart starts. And I can tell you this from my little kid point of view. And I can tell you the fucking heart starts beating. The autopsy guy, this normal dude, looks at it. And he's like, what's happening? Then it starts beating. But then it starts finding its own rhythm. And he's looking at it. And we're looking at different angles of it. And then he picks it up. And then he eats it. And I remember, because I was like, oh yeah, he just eats it. And then my eyes got it. It was turns up. But then if you watch it, it is 30 seconds of him eating the heart and spitting it out and black goo coming from his mouth and the performance of a lifetime.
It's incredible.
And then his coworker comes in and his face is covered in blood and he's like, hey, I'm going to give one-liners to the dead body of Jason. I'm like, your dude is covered in blood right now.
Is covered in blood.
You're not concerned by it.
The lack of concern with most people in a Friday the 13th horror movie where it's obviously something is not right, but they're I'm just going to, walk around as if nothing's happening. It's so funny. And when he pulls up the probes or whatever, and he's holding it threatening in front of him, he's like, yep, those are probes. I'm like,
hey,
wow.
You have a comment.
Wow.
I mean, I'm glad I saw it, but boy, oh boy. This movie is absolutely bananas. And so there's an interview we did on Dread Central. One of our writers, Gabe Theus, I believe, did an interview with the director of this movie, Adam Marcus. And Adam Marcus is saying, everyone gives me so much shit for this movie and how it turned out. But you tasked me to bring Jason back. Do you know how hard that is? And I was just no, I guess that's fair, I suppose. But then I watched that interview. I'm like, oh, yeah, that is kind of crazy. And then I watched this. And I'm like, I don't know, man. You really swung for the fences here.
I mean, you have. Okay.
But like, Mary Beth, you were talking about this. I respect it. But yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, you bring it up. But I made a note. So there's body swapping. There's body melting. Mm-hmm. There's heart eating. There's a torso cut in half. There's puppet monsters. Mm-hmm. There's these creatures from hell grabbing someone. There's the actual knife that changes. And then there's these rules for this monster that makes no sense, right? So it's if you eat a heart, inside of you grows this weird puppet thing. But you can take headshots or whatever. However, your chink in the armor is if you pass by a mirror, you're going to look like Jason in that mirror.
Look like Jason.
This is really weird narrative.
It's vampires.
But it covers a lot of ground. And then there's all these references to movies the Meyer House. And then there's a box from the Arctic that says Julia Carpenter on it. And, there's a Jaws quote in the middle of this movie. And he was having fun. He was having fun for sure.
He was.
What else can you fucking do when you're given the ninth Friday the 13th movie and you're like,
But not only that, but this story, the making of this movie, I would love to have a documentary on the amount of scripts and what they had to go through to get this, because apparently the filmmaker's initial pitch saw Elias Voorhees, Jason's father, digging up his body at the beginning of the film, eating his heart, taking on his supernatural powers, and embarking on a similar killing spree. And so someone was hired to turn that into a script, but apparently it was a hodgepodge and unintelligible. And so they hired someone else to scrap his work and write a completely new script within 4 days. removing Elias from the story, and then it felt like kind of connecting some of this, but apparently his initial idea for the film had Jason caught in a gang war in Los Angeles, and then he moved on to another project, and so then the studio turned to another person who provided polish to the script over a weekend, and then someone that wrote on House 4, The Repossession, was enlisted for further rewrites. So it's like, this is a hodgepodge of a script, and I think that's why there are so many ideas here. And what I find fascinating is that even after the movie has been out and everything, there's been interviews with the director who talks about that Jason Voorhees is... So I think this is really funny, because we're talking about Sam Raimi, we're talking about these weird demons. According to the director, Jason Voorhees is actually a deadite.
Right. From and there's the Necronomicon from Evil Dead.
What the fuck was that?
He picked up the Necronomicon. Well, he asked for it, and he was building in all this like crazy subtext lore, like, because I remember reading that too, Terry, and then like, and I totally forgot. I'm like, oh yeah, there's the Necronomicon.
And then there's the knife that Mary Beth is focused on, which is supposedly, like, even though it's not, it's supposed to be the Kandarian dagger, is like the idea behind it. And so the quote that Marcus came up this idea talking with Sam Raimi, and quote, she, Pamela Voorhees, makes a deal with the devil by reading from the Necronomicon to bring back her son. This is why Jason isn't Jason. He's Jason plus the Evil Dead. And now I can believe that he can go from a little boy that lives in a lake to a full grown man in a couple months to zombie Jason to never being able to kill this guy. That to me is a way more interesting mashup, and Raimi loved it.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm down. And like, I watched this and I like, there were things about this movie that I thought were so much more like, you know, Jason Goes to Manhattan is famously like people trash it, but it's fun. Like, you just meet it where it is, but it's like, you know, like he'll uppercut a dude's head off or something. But like this, like, the amount, as Mary Beth keeps on saying, just the wild ambition, the wild ideas in this film are crazy. There's so much fun. Like, that melting body sequence is like, that's it's a really great good Twitter gif. I mean, like, that is just a classic. Like, that's me, like, seeing that thing on Twitter. I'm like, okay, I'm watching this movie tonight. Like, I don't know.
That's the thing about this movie. It's like, it's incomprehensible in story, but it looks cool. Like, there's so many incredible moments of body horror, like when the guy's jaw just like melts off. It looks like the Blob. I don't really happen to anyone else, so who knows why that's happening. No. But you know what? Who cares? But there's just so many weird moments of body horror that are so well designed that you're like, a lot of love was put into this movie. It wasn't like someone like just said, fuck it, another Jason movie. Someone was like, we're going to put some really cool shit in here. So it's like, I have to respect that, you know? Even though I'm like, the story is nonsense. They've
it's tough. Yeah, they're really swinging for the fences. And I think Adam Marcus is very talented. I think the blocking, like, you know, even the, like, you know, I gotta put my guy Adam to task a little bit. I don't know if Steve was the best casting for the lead, but that might be a personal taste. I don't know.
No.
But like the fight scene between him and then like his mother-in-law and stuff, like, it was really surprising. There's like really fun like angles coming on, and it was like entertaining. I also thought that it was pretty crazy. This came out a year before Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which is like the original kind of like meta horror movie, and this is a total meta horror movie. And
it is.
They also have like the fake America's Most Wanted thing in the middle, which is really fun.
That was
too.
Okay. That was pretty cool.
The guy was a very cartoony bad guy, but I really love that they did the mixed media idea in it as well.
This franchise is so complicated behind the scenes, where it's like, from what I understand, Paramount Pictures owned Friday the 13th, but they allowed New Line Cinema to have the rights to the series, which granted them rights to Jason Voorhees, but Paramount retained control of the Friday the 13th title, which is why this is Jason Goes to Hell, the final, what, the final Friday the 13th, or the final Friday.
Yeah,
because they couldn't call it Friday the 13th. So there's that. And then they also, had an idea because New Line now owned the character that they wanted to do Freddy versus Jason. And so like that was like their initial goal was to do a Freddy versus Jason movie, but it wasn't working out. And so then they were like, well, we have to make another entry in this franchise. And so enter Jason Goes to Hell. But like I don't know, I find that the back and forth and the sort of things that are happening behind the camera in the Friday 13th franchise is just so fascinating because this is like a storied franchise and yet it has like it's still tied up today in like legal knots about, you know,
I know.
Will we ever see another Friday the 13th movie? Because who knows, a lot of people own we different parts of the rights and stuff. So it's just fascinating.
Well, I mean,
come on, Mary Beth.
It's like, you know, this movie, however you feel about it, like was the second worst performing, you know, movie in the franchise, but it was made for $3 million and made $13 million back. And so like, that's why the stuff is caught in legal battles. It's like, it doesn't matter what they put on the screen. There's like this audience that grew up with it, have this relationship with it, and they'll watch it all. Same with like, you know, Nightmare Before Elm Street or something. And I think that's why it gets complicated. I think I'm doing a lot of like, there. Okay, are we going to talk about some of the issues with the film a little bit?
Or sure. Yes.
Oh yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
So what is like? I think never. It just like doesn't age well. Obviously, like portrayal women in the series and just like the mildly pornographic nature of these movies. But what I found like really funny about it is like, okay, you know, this person we learn after, you know, the first sequence is like an undercover FBI. But she opens up and she's just going to Camp Crystal Lair and it's kind of set up like a dumb horror movie. It's like, why is this random person going into this old house? And then she does all the things like, you know, ringing the dinner bell for Jason to come. And he only comes after she gets naked in the shower. And it's like, for Friday the 13th, if you want to be killed, you have to actually get naked. And then then Jason will come for you. It was really weird to me.
He's the morality police, you know? You can't have premarital sex. You can't be naked, even if it's to take a shower. You can't smoke a marijuana or do any of those crazy drugs. All of that. Like, you know, it's otherwise the morality police is going to come here and punish you. And I love it. I do love that it leans into that with this opening, though. I have to say that I do, as silly as it is, I do love that it leans into that. Like, you know, at this point, you all know what's going to happen. Let's make a movie about it.
Well, and they,
it's just, I don't know.
They also lean into it with that. It's like the couple and their friend, they're camping and they're like, we're going to summon Jason. We're going to have sex. And then she's like, you can have the tent. I'm going to sleep out here. I'm like, I would fucking murder my friends, by the way, if anyone was like, can I have the tent? And be like, no, go fuck in the woods like normal people. Jesus. But I do love, again, there's like that inversion of it's not the couple having sex that's killed first. It's logically the girl who's sitting outside, like, because they're having sex, who's killed first. And and then they have the whole condom, like the weird condom exchange. I was like, yeah, the 90s, baby.
Gross. Yeah, that exchange was really gross. But it was funny, though. There is this shot where Jason's coming to kill him. It's like, walk down. And then, like, in the middle of that sequencing, you just see his boot step on the unused condom.
Yes.
And then he, like, continues.
Yes. I did very much appreciate that. My movie that I directed, we have a condom callback in it, which I find hysterical. So I'm glad I'm not the only person who finds condom humor in horror movies appropriate. So
what I love about this tent scene that you, John, watched through, it sounds like covered hands,
yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
But what I love about it is that it's sort of, I mean, it gives us some male nudity, which is lacking in a lot of these films. His butt is filmed very nicely with the camera. I have to say, I was like, okay, we're giving as much attention to the male form in this sequence as a lot of these films give to the female form. And I always find that surprisingly refreshing in this movie because we don't typically get that. And so I don't know, like that whole sequence. And then with her being split down the middle, like, okay, I was watching the unrated cut. This was because I was like, I have the Shout Factory set and I was like, ooh, this gives me a good reason to break it out. And I was like, I don't know which one to watch. I've only ever seen this movie one time before, so I'll go with the unrated cut. And I don't know if there's how much more is added, but like that is a really gnarly kill.
Oh yeah, that's a fucking great. I mean, it's like the thing, and then the reaction, then it's like the whole torso ripped in half. The whole
torso.
And you're just like, it's a whole body prop. It's so great. Yeah, and yeah, the guy's butt is filmed well, and then there's also yeah, the guy strapped in BDSM style. And then the mortician, like, really scarily shaves off his mustache. And the guy's more concerned about his mustache being shaved off than, like, his neck being shaved. He's like, fuck! But I agreed. I did find that kind of fun and unexpected about the film as well.
Tony the Wonder Llama, the line that he says, just, oy. What? What? There are times like that where I realize, yep, this really was written so quickly. But like, this movie is really horny because everyone just seems to want to fuck, like, yeah, everyone. That's which true. I guess is typical in a Friday the 13th movie, but like everyone wants to fuck in this movie.
Yeah, and Steve is just like picking up these hitchhikers and they like invite him. It's like, I wouldn't invite Steve. There's nothing about Steve I'm inviting to hang out, no, with my friends. I'm like, thanks for the ride, dude, but why are you still wearing a varsity jacket? Aren't you like 40? And he's just like, this is, he like has a kid that he's like a deadbeat dad. He still wears his varsity jacket. And he, the only backstory we get is that like, he was never around. And to the point where the woman he had this kid with was like, you know what? I'm better off taking this newborn alone, Steve, because you never show up to help. And he's just like prowling around in a leather jacket.
He also has like the dorkiest glasses. So I'm like, I don't, it's like the vibe just like does not totally work for me. I'm like, I don't.
No.
Nah, I don't, it doesn't work for me. Like the vibes you're trying to give, it was not cast very well in my humble opinion. He's
very much like the dude who's in the first kill, the boyfriend in Scream.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who might also be named Steve, right?
Oh my God, I think he is.
Yeah, he looks identical to that dude.
What? Okay, so what I find fascinating watching this now is the way in which it is structured, where we introduce Steve and it's like we don't know anything about him. Or at least unless I blinked and missed something, we know nothing about him. And so he just is introduced, and then later we find out that, you know, that he's involved with the woman. We see Diana and we have Creighton, who, what's his name?
Creighton Duke, that dark
tower looking motherfucker who's a bounty hunter hunting down Jason.
My favorite fact about this movie is that Steve Williams would only play Duke if he could dress as a cowboy. that was his request for the film. He's like down, but I have one like rider note.
You know what? So, good for him. Honestly, good for him.
Good for him.
Holy shit. Because
he opens up and it's like, and they like talk about an intro of a guy. They have like a whole like news segment about this guy, like a, you know, one of these news magazine, like 60 minute segments on Creighton Duke, world famous.
It's characters get introduced before we have any idea like why we should care about them, because then, you know, Diana in Creighton Duke is like talking to Diana and is like, I know who you are, and then it's just revealed, you know, sort of casually that she's related to Jason Voorhees. But it's like all of these little beats that feel like this should be either something we know going into the introduction, or something that should be a shocking secret later. It's just like, yeah, that's Steve, he's I guess the father of my baby. Like, I don't know. It's just things happen after the character's been introduced. And it's like, oh, now I guess we should care about him because of this. But that wasn't initially suggested. And it continues with Creighton Duke, who is a wild ass character. But sort of like how Marcus talks about that, you know, after the fact that Jason is actually a deadite. The story of Creighton Duke is apparently... a teenage Creighton was out on Crystal Lake with his girlfriend, and Jason capsized their small boat and pulled the girl down into the lake. Creighton tried to save her, but could not. She was never seen again.
Wait,
so Creighton vowed revenge, and from that moment, He spent his life and study in pursuit of Jason. He became a bounty hunter just to fund his work in taking down his nemesis. That's a story. And that is what is quoted by Marcus after the fact in an interview, I think in 2017, well, maybe.
Wait, he just like retconned, he retconned all of that, or just like said that in an interview, just like offhandedly about the character?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to Marcus's defense, this is very apparent in the film. I mean, you watch this, and that backstory is just like infused.
It really shines through. Yeah.
But like, also, like all these flashbacks, like, okay, Necronomicon. I mean, so I like Mary Beth was like referencing when you guys talked with him on Dread Central. Like, maybe he had this version of the script where he's like, it opens up. And we see the Evil Dead reference. We see the Deadites stuff.
Yeah.
And then like, and then it jumps like 20 years later. Then we see like, you know, a more wholesome Crichton Duke, you know, maybe back when he was like Marshall Duke or something, you know, before he took on an alias. And he's with like, his girlfriend brought out this like really sweet, sensitive side we never really knew about him. And they're like, they have this really great moment. And then this capsized Jason. And then we cut. And now we see him as this guy who's, it seems like he really only cares about money, but we learn later that he actually cares.
It's basically Moby Dick. You know, he is searching for that white whale.
Is this the Moby Dick of the Jason franchise?
I think it might be. Honestly be. Wow. Wow.
One of the moments though that I still love to this day, and it made me kind of a little bit sad, is Leslie Jordan. I love.
Weird diner woman's.
Yeah, and is married to Joey B, who is the most drag queen-esque performance, I would say. It reminded me sort of like Divine trying to be a woman, like trying to like, I don't know, it reminded me of a drag queen performance. And so she is this overbearing woman, and he is a very milquetoast with his hat on backwards, because, you know, gotta be straight acting. It's just, I don't know, it's just, I love their relationship so much,
but like
that I every single time I get to it, I'm just like, oh, I love
it. But like, it's a totally different movie. Like, what the fuck movie?
It
like,
is
like a John Waters movie, like absolutely like out of left field tonally, which like whatever, it's just like, I don't know, it just feels like there's a lot of things going on when there could have been less things and more refining, is, I guess. But I also understand that there's a lot of weird cooks in the kitchen, and it's the ninth Jason movie, so I don't know. I don't have a solution here.
No, I agree. I see this as, like, you know, one of these, like, cast the characters tell, like, two cities type story, where it's like, you know, we're just learning about a whole town and a whole mythology.
Yeah.
But, like, I do love, I love what I loved about that restaurant scene. I do love their relationship. I think it's really sweet. I think the whole thing feels kind of Stephen Kingy, which is fun because they're characters of Americana or something. But then the like the Jason hamburger patties, because they're celebrating that Jason has finally died. And like, I remember that really disturbed me. Like someone putting their fingers in hamburger patties. Like, which again, it's like, I was probably, I don't know, maybe I wasn't, but I have a suspicion I was a little too young to watch this movie at that age.
Quite possibly.
Maybe.
Yeah. But that hamburger scene, I also, maybe I was just like in the cone of, I'm going to be disturbed watching this movie. So even the hamburgers kind of scared me at that point.
Well, like, it's just like the whole tone is just bizarre. It just like feels kind of grotesque.
It's like we entered Twin Peaks.
Yes.
That's what it reminds me of. It's like we've entered Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And we're also in a Friday the 13th movie. But I think the hockey mask hamburgers are so like corporately smart, because
you're saving money. Corporately smart.
Oh.
You're saving money. You're like poking out the eyes and you're saving money. And so you're selling them what's basically probably half a hamburger.
Sure. Now, integrity wise, would the meat coalesce over the holes, or do you think you could still keep the hockey mask intact after grilling?
I kind of hope they take those little metal holes and stick it in the meat so that it sears the sides of the And yeah, you know, holds its shape. You got to hold the shape. Otherwise, what are you doing?
If you're paying like $9 for a Jason Dead burger, you got to commit to the bit.
Well, and they're 2-for-1. So, I mean, it makes sense that we're also taking away all the meat so we can make a second burger. Like, I think they're coming out on top with this idea. I think it's actually kind of smart.
Yeah, Joey's pretty savvy running this operation. Also, the kill of the husband, the face in the fryer.
I always hate those.
Yeah,
those I just like, I can feel that.
There was a movie recently that had the face in the fryer bit. It was really disturbing.
Oh my gosh. I do know what you're talking about, but I don't remember what movie it was.
Yeah.
Nope.
But yeah, a lot of firsts in this. They couldn't have been the first with that face in the fryer. Now, okay. But let's go back to the meta horror thing. It wasn't as meta horror as Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which I think broke ground in a really cool, exciting way.
It felt like they were trying to do something similar, but they were almost like too scared to go all the way, if that makes sense. Like they towed the line, but I feel like they didn't necessarily push it hard enough to like go fully into that meta horror. Like they fell back into it being like your standard slasher at the end.
Well, no, I agree. I think it's like somewhere between like, it's like Wes Craven's New Nightmare meets Monster Squad, as far as, you know, like breaking new ground. Because it's like so comic booky. It's still like, takes the idea as if it's like a comic book versus like, you know, like a Frank Miller comic, like Dark Knight Returns or something, where like it inverses the medium and takes it like seriously, like Scream kind of did. I think this movie still sees horror movies as really still.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That is a very good way to put it. It does still see horror movies as silly.
Two things I want to talk about. One is just a comment. I love, you always know when shit is going to get real in a movie when a woman either cuts her hair or ties her hair back. And we get that point in here where Jessica is like putting her hair back in like that small ponytail and she's off to the races. It's such a small, like it's, I don't know. It's a cliche, but I love to see it. It's like, oh shit, shit's going to get real. Putting your hair back.
Put it back. Can't fuck around. Gets in your face.
No, we haven't really talked about the Jason infant or the Jason larva or the Jason mutated heart that going with the idea of Evil Dead goes up into the dead body of Diana through her vagina to possess her. Again, very like Evil Dead-ish, but it's also like, what? And then just the them saying, you know, like, oh, yep, has to be born of one. Can it work on a dead body? I guess it can, because now he's Jason.
Yeah.
No. Crane Duke says, Holy Mother of God. And then we see the house rumbling and smoke coming up from the base.
Holy Mother of God. I mean, it's... I gotta applaud it for existing, you know? Like, it's definitely not a good movie, but I had a good time watching it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, when I saw that, again, it's kind of... I think it's really unfair to meet art where it's like not at, whether it's Jason Goes to Hell or you're like trying to compare a Norman Rockwell painting to something. You know, it's like whatever it is, you have to meet it where it's at. And I think and if you just like, you're like, okay, this is the movie we're gonna watch, like, you know, and there's some things that are extremely outdated that are happening. But like, I was like, fuck yes, there's a puppet monster that has its own voice screeching that has now just been introduced out of nowhere and is just like squirming around like, what is happening
right, you know, now? The normal things.
Yeah, exactly. And then I just added it to my list. I'm like, body snatcher, puppet work. But I really never thought about it, Terry, until you were saying it, where it's like, okay, so if you eat the heart, is that like the parasite that grows in your body from the heart? Or is that just one of the many things that exist inside the heart that hatches out of you?
That's it's such great questions that I don't fully understand. I don't think I fully understood that it was a heart either. I was like, because I just yelled, oh my God, it's Jason Voorhees covered in ramen noodles as a fetus crawling out of a man's neck. Because I was just like, wait a second. What? He's a... What? But he really is just like a larva, like a little larva just scooting around screaming.
So in your defense or my defense or someone's defense, I am not 100% sure. But, like, I'm basing this off of what Wikipedia says, where it says Jason's heart, which has grown into a demonic infant, crawls out of Randy's neck. And so I was like, sure, that's what it is. I'll go with that.
Yeah, because it's this weird mix of, like, obviously alien, but then it's, like, Eraserhead and, like maybe, like, a like Ghoulies. Sometimes I was watching this, I'm like, this feels like I'm watching a fucking Ghoulies sequel or something. I was like,
yeah,
this is just going so off the rails and insane right now that, like, everything's happening. And I kept on, like, pausing and just, wow, like, what? Like, this is...
I can't take my eyes away from this movie. Everything is happening. That's so true. Everything is happening in this movie.
But I also, it was giving me Nightmare on Elm Street 5, the Dream Child vibes too, with like the baby fetus. Like there's all of like, it's just, I don't know, maybe this movie is referencing all of them because it does have a lot of movie references throughout. Maybe that's what they're going for. But it gave me a little bit of like Infant Freddy in the Dream Child.
Oh yeah,
we're talking about it. I was feeling this way, and I'm not trying to jump the gun here, but I'm surprised this movie isn't included in more lists where it's like, oh, I want to watch a fun like movie for Halloween. What should I watch? Would you guys recommend it in that scope, or would you be like, with some caveats?
With some caveats, I think
this is. I think this is a perfect party movie. You get like some booze or your imbibing of choice. You go and watch this movie with a bunch of friends and you laugh. I think under that circumstance would be a great time. There's a lot of great ideas in this movie. It just those narrative threads connecting them. It's obvious that it was a rushed script in that regard. It feels very rushed, but there's some great swing for the fence ideas here that, and I don't think this is any of the fault of either the director or the screenwriter. I want to be very clear on that. I think that this is like a situation where like, we got to get a movie go. And so you do what you have to do for the job. So like, I don't think there's anything like technically wrong with, although the script is incomprehensible, but again, I don't think that is necessarily the fault of the screenwriter. I think it's...
No, and it's also, and I totally agree with you, because I really do, and I'm not, I know I'm being like kind of silly and whatever, but like, I do think like Adam Marcus is a very talented director, and like,
yeah,
because you watch some of these slashers and they're like fun or whatever, but like, the fight scenes were really good. Like his coverage and blocking is great. And especially like all you have to do to know that is that opening sequence where he pays an homage to like the whole series and like just like a handful of shots. And it's like, and he's able to create a lot of surprise tension jump scares from a slamming of a door in a surprising way. So I really agree. And I also think like, even as a silly movie, like, it's also hard to fault him because like 1993, this is coming like right off the heels of the late 80s slasher movies where like, you know, Freddy Krueger is in sunglasses and is doing a TV segment from the beach or whatever. Like there was a pretty big suspension of disbelief, but it kind of was at the platform and missed the last train of like 80s suspension of disbelief. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, FYI, like Pulp Fiction's coming out in a year. So things are completely different now. And Jason Goes to Hell, you're in a new arena.
I think that's very important because, you know, when we look at what's happening in like the early 90s, cinema was taking like a darker turn with like, you mentioned, like, you know, we're going to get Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. We're going to get, it's like the grunge time. It's like industrial music is hitting its key. We're having like Jacob's Ladder. We're having, you know, that type of film. Candyman is in a few years. Like that is the type of stuff that we're doing. And this feels like just hanging on of the 80s that people were ready to move on from. It seemed like in cinema and go from that kind of fun 80s time frame to a more, I mean, Alien 3 came out a year before this, and that is the bleakest of any of the Alien movies. So it's like, I don't know. I think it's so weird that this movie exists when it does, at a time when cinema was seemed to be moving away from the very poppy, The Blob or the Nightmare on Elm Streets or the, you know, the Jasons into something more grungy.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a weird relic of that time frame.
I agree. I was like, because I was thinking about it. I did a fun, like 2 years ago, a double feature around Shocktober time, but I did a Bad Ronald with Brain Damage. And I wonder if Brain Damage and Jason Goes to Hell would be a fun double feature.
You know what? I think it would be. I think that's the way to do it. I think it's the way to do it.
But Brain Damage is really cool, but that's, I just looked it up, 1988, you know, and then this is 1993. And so it was kind of but when did Shocker come out? Because I feel like Shocker has like a similar vibe as Jason.
Oh, Shocker. That came out in 89.
See, I think this is what, because I think if Jason Goes to Hell came out in 1988 or 89, people would have been really down.
That's a good point.
But it was the 90s. It was a new decade,
new rules.
Well, do we want to wrap up and give this our ratings out of 5?
Okay,
sounds like a plan.
One coda for this film.
Okay.
I watched this film, and then I was a big doodler growing up as a kid, and all my drawings started to get covered in blood and dismembered body parts. And my teacher called my mom into school. And of course, I have not told my mom I've seen this movie. And I'm like writing hell on my pieces of paper. And my mom, and she's like, I think there's something wrong with your kid. And my mom like looks at the paper, and then she's like, I want you to like look around, like, show me everyone else's drawing. You're going to see like a sun in the corner and a house and floating families. Like, she's like, my son's really creative and you can never tell him that like he's doing something wrong for expressing his creativity. And I was like, and she had no idea I saw this movie, by the way. And there's like a photo of me like really happy as a kid with this insane drawing, but like, it looks like a kid drawing. But if you look at it, there's like a floating bloody hand. I'll send this to you guys. You can see like Freddy's hand coming out of the ground, taking down like the mask. And it's just like, and you know, my mom was just like, no, like this is him being creative. And like, who are you to say that this is wrong?
Your mom fucking rules. I love her.
That's awesome.
My mom really does rule. She didn't have the full story. I was like the youngest of 4, but
still, she's standing up for the right thing. Standing up for your creativity and loving what you love. That's a mom right there. I love that.
She's the best. She is the best. So, although I saw that movie at a very young age, at a very supportive household.
That's
rallying
amazing.
Behind my demonic drawing.
I love that.
No
love
questions
that.
Asked. Oh. Just being like, no, this is fine. Don't you dare keep him from his dreams.
That's fucking right. Wait, I think I... Wait. Okay, I'll pull this up as we're giving our...
Hell yeah. Okay. All right, Terry, you're up first. How many Laurel Jasons out of 5 do you give Jason Goes to Hell : The Final Friday?
You know... This I find this movie really hard to rate because on one hand, I don't think it's a very good movie. But on the other hand, I had a blast watching it last night. And so, like, I think, John, you said something about meeting art at where it's at. And I think that if I meet this one at what it's trying to do, it's still not wholly successful. It's still... But again, I don't think that it's really any of the creatives involved with it. It's just... the 9th movie in a franchise that is not allowed to use Friday the 13th anymore because it's New Line and it has to have a new movie, probably because they're like, we got to get a new movie out. We got to try to get some investment paid on investment of this rights. It just, everything behind the scene, I think, kind of detracts from what this movie could have been. And yet I still had a lot of fun with it. I still think as a queer fan of slasher movies, I am happy that there is some, you know, equal opportunity nudity in this. I love the weird, you know, homoerotic subtext of a lot of what's going on. It's fun. So I'm going to give it a 3.5. I'm going to cut that larva in half. I'm just going to give it 3.5 for what it is. I had a good time with this one. What about you, Mary Beth?
I'm giving it 2. I'm sorry. I'm giving it 2 larval Jasons.
That's fine.
I definitely understand, like, meeting it where it's at, and I appreciate it for what it is. I didn't understand a lick of what was happening in this movie. And you know what? I welcome that, and I respect it. It's not for me. And you know what? That's fine, because not every movie is for me. And I can say that I enjoyed a lot of the special effects. I can enjoy, again, just really going for, I can always very much appreciate when a film is just being like, fuck it, we ball, kind of, and just being like, we're just going to go for it. And it's Adam Marcus's first movie at a film school. Like, you know what? I feel bad saying 2, but like, it's what's in my heart, but I appreciate it for what it is. I sound wishy-washy, but this is who I am. Anyway, John, you have the final word. How many larval Jasons out of 5 do you give Jason Goes to Hell?
I think the most controversial thing I'll say in this interview is, like, I'm not the biggest Friday the 13th fan series. Like, I think it's fun, and like a lot of my friends and, you know, really, really love it. And I should have a really deep connection to it, but I really don't. I really like the first one. I think it's great. And then other than that, and like, I've seen the 3D one so many times because my friend has it on DVD and he always makes us watch it. But I think as the series goes, this is like the most entertained outside the first one I am in the Friday the 13th series. And in the spirit of meeting it where it's at, I'm giving it a 4. I'm giving it 4 worms of body out of the ramen noodle heart creature that squeals. And it's related to the lore, and it's probably, you know, in Evil Dead, worm things out of butt.
Cool.
There Sick. We go.
Hell yeah.
I love
yeah.
That. So I do want to put, you said that you're not a huge fan of the Friday the 13th. Were you a slasher fan? Did you have one? Because, like, I'm a Fredhead. I'm a Freddy fan in terms of, like, the typical slasher from the 80s. Did you like, yeah, did I you mean, gravitate towards one?
It depends. Like, I think, as far as slasher goes, like, now, today, if you would consider Texas Chainsaw Massacre slasher, I'm not sure what that falls into. But, like, I think Scream is canon, one of the best horror films of all time. Like, I love that movie. I love that franchise. I really like, again, fun ones, like Slaughter High. Cool. And, like, kind of, like, fun, silly slashers from the 80s, especially, like, you know, Dream Warriors and stuff, you know? And so, yeah, like, I like slashers. I don't know if I've seen one recently that has, like, really taken that genre and, like, gone somewhere really cool in an interesting way for me. But maybe I just haven't seen it. Maybe has there been something that's come out recently that's, like, really cool in that space?
It's not really my genre either. So I don't really gravitate to it.
Maybe it's ripe. Maybe it's ripe for like a really fun left field one. But yeah, no, I like slashers. I think what I like about slashers are, like, they really are this culmination of what I enjoy about horror movies, where it's like, again, a roller coaster. Like, you're buying the ticket, you're taking the ride, like, and you know what you're getting, and they're really fun, and it's like kind of like the essence of that. And usually the best ones are, like, in the 80s, so that's always, like, just this fun snapshot of the country and the mindset back then. I love fun. Yeah.
Cool.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you, John, for joining us to talk about Jason Goes to Hell. Are you on social media? Where can our listeners find you? And the floor is yours to plug away.
Yeah. New.life.film, I believe, is our Instagram. I don't know. I mean, listen, New Life is coming to limited theaters and VOD May 3rd. And you should rent it and pre-order. I think it's really good. People have liked it. I like it.
It's great.
I'm terrible. I need to get better about selling my movie, but it's good. You should pre-rent it. I think you'll like it. Go in cold. That's what I'm gonna say about my film. If you go in cold, you'll be really surprised. And if you listen to, you know, this far, thank you. I really appreciate you hearing me ramble about this movie from my life, and me being somewhere in the middle of the guest that Mary Beth and Terry.
Well, listeners. You've heard from us. We want to hear from you. Can you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What is your experience with Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday? I can talk, I promise. Send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com or reach out to us directly on social media. I am at mbmcandrews on Twitter and at mb.mcandrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, please follow the podcast on social media, on Twitter and Blue Sky at Scarred Podcast, and on Instagram at Scarred for Life Podcast.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.